Hello and welcome to Volume 44, Number 21 of your weekly local news magazine, Grapevine. Brought to you by the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association, this edition is published on Friday the 24th of May 2024. Hi, I'm Graham, your presenter, joined this week by newsreader Margaret. And in this week's issue, a disabled man is arrested, causing controversy. Market Gates bus station is to change. The North Drive beach huts are no more. And a one-ship Spanish Armada to hit Hawkey. In addition, Andy has the weird Norfolk story of a very haunted pub. All this coming your way during the next hour or so. Well, there are no birthdays this week, but we have a sad announcement. We're very sad to report that the death has been announced of Doreen King. Long-term listeners may remember that Doreen's voice was regularly heard on Grapevine over many years, as both a reader and presenter. Doreen passed away peacefully on May the 14th, aged 91, leaving husband Dick, also a valued Grapevine member, their children, grandchildren and great-grandchildren. The funeral service will be held at Galston Crematorium on Monday, June the 10th at 1:45 p.m. Family flowers only, please, and formal dress is optional, but a splash of colour is preferred. Donations, if desired, to East Anglia's Children's Hospices or Operation Smile UK, care of Arthur Jerry and Sons, 43 High Street, Galston, NR316RR, or telephone 01493 662 389, or online via Doreen-Rose-King at muchloved.com. That's Doreen-Rose-King at muchloved.com. It goes without saying that all of us at Grapevine send our condolences to Dick and the family for their sad loss. Well, after that sad news, it's over to this week's newsreader, Margaret.
Hello, I'm Margaret, bringing you the news this week. And what a grey day it is, but never mind. I think the weather forecast is pretty good for the weekend. It had better be. So, if you're sitting comfortably, I'll begin with the first of the stories. A barn fire. Fire crews spent the night battling a blaze at a barn in a seaside village. The service was called to Lowestoft Road in Hopton just before 10 p.m. last Saturday after reports of an agricultural outbuilding catching light. Video footage captured by Oliver Drone Photography shows the barn filled with straw on fire. People living nearby were warned to keep their windows closed, and people in Lowestoft said the smoke can still be smelled this morning. The cause of the fire currently remains unknown. And possibly some good news about buses. Bus station changes. New plans could see buses travelling in both directions through Market Gates in Great Yarmouth. The project would see new bus stops and crossing points created, as well as a number of changes to current highway arrangements across neighbouring streets. Norfolk County Council is asking residents for their views on the proposals by completing an online survey at www.norfolk.gov.uk/marketgates. Due to the size of the area covered by the proposals, a number of large-scale plans are also available to view, with hard copies to take away if required from any of the following locations: Market Gates Shopping Centre, Great Yarmouth Town Hall, Kingsgate Centre, Queen Anne's Road, Shroblands Community Cafe, Magdalen Way, Galston, and Great Yarmouth Gorston or Caister Libraries. A list of frequently asked questions are available on the project webpage, and residents can also email tfnorfolk@norfolk.gov.uk or call the council directly with any questions about the proposals or require information on an alternative format. The consultation is live until Sunday, June the 16th, and the project webpage above will be kept up to date with the latest progress and information. Councillor Graham Plant, Cabinet Member for Highways, Infrastructure and Transport, said, "Through our bus service improvement plan, we've committed to improving bus services and sustainable transport facilities across the county." He said the proposal represents another major investment in Great Yarmouth, which seeks to build on the fantastic progress already made with the low fare cap and a number of new and enhanced bus services introduced across the region. Herring Bridge has already made a massive difference to traffic flows around the town, and these proposals seek to capitalise on this shift to ensure our bus infrastructure is fit for purpose to support the future growth of the region with all of the wider investments currently being made, he added. And a nice story about a fish and chip shop. Why do I always have to read out items about food when I'm hungry? Never mind. Here I go then. Fish in Bags Top Honour. A fish and chip shop near Great Yarmouth has earned its place among the best in the UK. The Fish Inn in Bradwell is frying high after bagging a quality accreditation from the National Federation of Fish Fryers, NFFF, sponsored by Sarsen's Vinegar for the first time. The NFFF is the trade body that represents the nation's fish and chip shops and runs the scheme as a way of raising standards within and enhancing the profile of the fish and chip industry. In a statement, the Fish Inn Bradwell said, "We're delighted to gain our place in the scheme. To be recognised as one of the top fish and chip shops by the NFFF is indeed an honour and a credit to our hard-working staff, who I would like to offer my sincere thanks for the continued hard work and efforts to maintain our excellent reputation." The business thanked its customers for their support and encouragement. "It's motivated us to maintain our high standards, which have been recognised with this accreditation," they said. "The scheme is a way of rewarding and promoting shops that provide good quality products and high standards of hygiene, as well as fryers who show a high level of competence. To qualify, each shop must go through a virtual inspection by an NFFF-approved assessor who assesses the shop's presentation, hygiene and cleanliness, staff training, equipment, frying and sales skills, and most importantly, the quality of the cooked product." NFFF President Andrew Crook said, "The Fish Inn Bradwell clearly takes pride in where it sources its fish and potatoes from. Achieving the NFF quality accreditation provides reassurance to customers that they are being served cooked food using high quality ingredients. Each fish and chip quality accreditation is valid for a year, and retention is dependent on standards being maintained as validated by NFFF officials and appointment assessors." Sightings of an insect that can eat up to 50 honeybees a day have sparked fears that the invasive species may soon arrive in Norfolk. Nature groups warn that recent flooding and warming temperatures have increased the risk of a spike in the numbers of Asian murder hornets. The public has been urged to report any sightings of the hornet amid fears the bug will move up the UK after becoming established in Kent. Richard Benwell, Wildlife and Countryside Link Chief Executive, said, "Invasive species are already one of the biggest threats to the UK environment, from smothering waterways to outcompeting native species. They also cause billions of pounds of damage in a year to homes and businesses and even pose risks to human health. Asian hornets pose a serious threat to British bees, and the British Pest Control Association, BPCA, has said any sightings should be immediately reported and dealt with by professionals. Slightly smaller than native European hornets, Asian hornets are black or dark brown with a distinctive yellow band at the rear. They also have bright yellow tips to the legs, a yellow belt at the waist with an orange or yellow face. Oh my word, that's a bit scary. Liquid thrown over cars. A male in an illuminated mask is among the suspects after an unknown liquid was thrown over two cars in Galston. In the early hours of May the 2nd, an unknown liquid was thrown over two cars in a driveway in St Anne's Crescent, and one of the car windows was smashed. The suspects have been described as two males, with one of them wearing an illuminated mask. It comes after a similar incident in Walpole Road in Great Yarmouth between 6 p.m. on May the 1st and 7 a.m. on May the 2nd, when a car had a paint-like white fluid thrown over its window. Police are appealing for any information regarding the two incidents. Anybody with CCTV or dash cam footage has been asked to contact the Norfolk Constabulary. A man in a wheelchair charged. A police officer who appeared to strike a disabled man in a violent incident in Great Yarmouth has not been suspended. The confrontation, which was captured on video and circulated on social media, happened between 5 p.m. and 6 p.m. on Monday, May the 20th, on St Peter's Road. The 24-second clip shows the policeman involved in a violent struggle with the man, landing around half a dozen blows on him. Norfolk Constabulary has confirmed the officer is currently not at work. They said he had not been suspended at this time, while the Independent Office for Police Conduct, IOPC, assessed the incident. And the force has referred the incident to its Professional Standards Department and the IOPC. Witnesses said the incident began after the man in the wheelchair, who was disabled with only one leg, was seen in the middle of the road holding a bottle of alcohol. It's understood the police officer then arrived at the scene and started pushing the man back onto the path near the Londis shop. Norfolk police said the man threatened the officer with a bottle and spat at him. Onlookers said they were shocked by the incident and have criticised the officer's actions, saying it has left them afraid of the police. A man was due to appear at Norwich Magistrates Court on Wednesday, May the 22nd, in relation to the incident. Michael McQueen, 37, of Hall Quay in Great Yarmouth, has been charged with assaulting an emergency worker using threatening, abusive, insulting words or behaviour. This is all about Steve Morphew. The leader of the Labour group at Norfolk County Council has been re-elected for the 8th year in a row. Steve Morphew, who represents Catton Grove Division, was re-elected unoppososed by his group. Mike Smith Clare, who represents Yarmouth Nelson and Southtown, continues as deputy leader, having taken on the role in autumn last year. Mr Morphew said, "This is a big year, with county council elections next year, following closely after the general election. If we have a Labour government, we need a strong and experienced local Labour presence to make sure Norfolk isn't let down by the county Tories. I'm proud to lead the Labour group, and even prouder we are working in the interests of the whole of Norfolk. Our Labour label tells people what our values are, but we're here for everyone in parts of the county. Labour are the third largest party at County Hall, with 10 councillors. The Conservatives, who control the council with 54 councillors, re-elected Kay Mason-Billig as their group leader last month. And as we all know now, general election is on the 4th of July, so they've got 6 weeks to rattle on our doors and tell us what they're going to do. A burglary in a Hopton village is being investigated after four Segway electric scooters were stolen. Police are appealing for information following the incident at the business premises, which happened between 5 p.m. on Saturday, May the 18th, and 9 a.m. on Sunday, May the 19th. Suspects forced entry into an area where six Segways were being charged and unplugged four of them. One was found abandoned nearby, three others are still missing. Anybody with information is asked to contact Norfolk Police. The moment a car narrowly avoided hitting a mobility scooter before crashing into the side of a convenience store has been caught by CCTV. A Ford Fiesta crashed into an advertisement bollard and the front of the spa shop on Gorston High Street shortly after 10:30 a.m. on Monday, May the 20th. As the car left the road, it appeared to have been within inches of hitting a mobility scooter outside the shop. People on the street rushed to the scene moments after the collision. The East Anglian Ambulance Service was on scene, but no injuries were reported. A shop assistant who was in the store at the time said the building shook during the crash. At the time of the crash, security camera footage appears to show the Fiesta driver swerving out of the way of a taxi, which had started to turn into the taxi rank by the bus stop. There were no road closures in place as the car was removed from the scene later that morning. And it's reported that no arrests were made. A pair of new mechanical road sweepers will boast a Great Yarmouth fleet of street cleaning vehicles. The Bosch Chung S2 sweepers have replaced two ageing machines at Great Yarmouth Services, the council's company which oversees waste and street cleaning. The manufacturers recently travelled to the town to deliver 2 days of staff training on the new vehicles, and they are now in operation around the borough. Great Yarmouth Borough Council says the new sweepers are more fuel efficient than the previous vehicles and also have cleaner engines, an increased payload, and can be operated on a standard car driving licence. Great Yarmouth Services selected the new model, having had a similar one on its fleet since 2021, which has deemed very successful. Councillor Paul Wells, Great Yarmouth Borough Council's portfolio holder for environment, sustainability and waste, said, "We know how important street cleaning is to our residents and visitors to the borough. The team at Great Yarmouth Services works extremely hard, and these new vehicles will help build on the work it does. The sweepers are cost-effective and efficient and are a valuable new addition to the fleet as we continue to focus on delivering the highest standards of street cleaning possible. Of course, we always urge visitors and residents to help us by ensuring they always use the correct waste and recycling bins and never litter or fly-tip rubbish." Great Yarmouth Services also recently took delivery of Norfolk's first fully electric refuse collection vehicle as part of the Council's net zero strategy. As part of its net zero strategy, the Borough Council has also invested in new charging infrastructure, specialist tools, equipment and HGV fitter training to allow staff to carry out routine maintenance and repairs on the new vehicle. As part of a trial earlier this year, the council also took delivery of two new electric vans to join the Great Yarmouth Services fleet. Tall ship Galleon Andalusia in Great Yarmouth. A Spanish tall ship, described as a floating museum, is sailing into Great Yarmouth next week. A replica of the 17th century Spanish galleon, Galleon Andalusia, will arrive at the town's South Quay. The ship will transport people back to the age of seafaring pirates as crews dressed in period costumes show what life was like on board. The ship is 162 feet long, 33 feet wide, with its seven sails covering a surface of almost 11,000 square feet. Taking 3 years of research and two more to construct, Galleon Andalusia was launched in 2009 and has covered 70,000 nautical miles in its world voyage. Ruth Cockrell, Great Yarmouth Borough Council's marketing events officer, said the visit promises to give a fascinating day out for people of all ages. She is a truly incredible ship, and we can't wait for her arrival. It promises to be a stunning spectacle for people to enjoy on the South Quay. Tickets will cost £12 per adult, £6 per child, or £30 for a family ticket with two adults and up to three children. The ship will arrive in time for half term and is open to visitors from May the 28th until June the 9th. Vandals targeting beach huts in Great Yarmouth have forced a business owner to get rid of them for good. The owner of Munchie's Cafe on the North Beach Promenade said the repeated attacks on his four beach huts have forced his hand, as he cannot keep repairing the huts for them to be attacked again. The dog-friendly cafe owner, Mark Allen, said it would be the end of an era, as beach huts had been based on that stretch of beach for more than 50 years. "It's a real shame. We're a local cafe and know most of our customers very well, and they're just as upset about it as we are." The overnight attacks began throughout the May bank holiday weekend. Mr. Allen said CCTV cameras showed nine youths in dark clothing ripping wooden panels off of one hut before throwing them on the beach. Mr. Allen repaired the hut on Monday, May the 5th, but the hut was attacked again over the next two nights, with the hut even being rolled over. All four beach huts were also attacked in the early hours of the morning of May the 20th. "We only spotted two people on CCTV this morning, but we can't make out who they are," he said. "This is going to put an end to it for us. One hut is used for storage while the other three have been used as the rentals during the summer. Lots of families have had a lot of pleasure being based here year after year, but this has put an end to it. That's very sad." Mr. Allen said the huts have been kept empty, so he could not see any reason why people would be targeting them. "Goodness knows why," he said. "They're not going to be worth repairing now. I'll just have to take them away. It's the end of beach huts here. Police inquiries are ongoing." A group of independent Norfolk veterinary practices have had a shareholder shake-up. Westover Vets has been providing veterinary services in North Walsham for more than 100 years, and the surgery is partnered with fellow independent practices Caister and Cromer Vets, which have been running since 2017 and 2021 respectively. Now all three practices have appointed new shareholders from within to secure the group's independence for years to come. Simon Busey Dyke, Zach Leovold, and Helen Boast have been appointed directors at Westover, Caister and Cromer Vets. The trio take the group to six shareholders, joining existing directors Tom Hume, Toby Morell and Anne-Marie Davis. Helen Boast said, "We're really proud of our achievements and strongly believe in investing in the business and local community to give the best service we can to clients and their pets. One of our big recent investments has been a state-of-the-art CT scanner. We're always striving to achieve the best patient care and client satisfaction and hope to do so for many more years to come." Wheels Festival returns. A huge motor vehicle festival with heart-stopping stunts, superbikes, classic cars, a wall of death and an 8-foot robot is returning to the town. A lineup of more than 500 motor vehicles will transform Great Yarmouth Seafront for the Wheels Festival on Saturday, June the 29th and Sunday, June the 30th. The two-day extravaganza will be hosted by an international stunt team and Guinness World Record holders for a free weekend of events to celebrate all things wheels. New for 2024 is Britain's Got Talent, 8-foot-tall semi-finalist Titan the Robot. The Guinness World Record holders, Stanage International Stunt Team, who have been performing worldwide since 2000 with fire and high fall stunts, will be headlining with two shows a day. A 2.5 kilometre long vehicle display will include emergency vehicles, superbikes, classic cars and old military vehicles. State-of-the-art Tesla electric cars will offer drive-outs, while Roger Blighty, a wacky bike plane pilot, whizzes along the seafront on his bicycle with biplane wings. The Ken Fox Hell Riders, who race around the 20-foot-high vertical wall of death on vintage Indian Scout motorcycles, are back by popular demand, with a show that has wowed the public for 100 years. Also on display is a Formula One car simulator and a historic Rolls-Royce Merlin engine used in Spitfires, complete with its propellers. Organised for the first time by Visit Great Yarmouth, CEO Asa Morrison said, "We've worked to deliver an incredible selection of acts for everyone to enjoy in the 2 days of great family fun and spectacle to remember. There's the wow factor, the comedy, the nostalgia, the wacky and the unusual vehicles everyone enjoys." Lyndon Bevan, chair of Visit Great Yarmouth, said, "We are so excited about this year's programme and how it will draw people from far and wide to enjoy what Great Yarmouth Seafront has to offer."
Well, more news in just a while. First, though, we welcome Trevor to the mic. This week, we'll look at the early days of flying.
These days, we think nothing of jetting off somewhere on holiday or a business trip in a heavier-than-air machine. This time, I'm talking about the development of civil aviation, from flying a kite to the jet age, to fine dining at 30,000 feet, with my four-part Wings Over the World. This is part one, in the beginning. Would you believe it all started with a kite? It was the Chinese around 400 BC who discovered a kite could fly. This started us humans thinking about flying. For centuries we tried flying just like birds, with wings made of feathers or lightweight wood attached to our arms to try and help us fly. The thing is, our arms aren't really kitted out for flying like birds, and the result was often disastrous. In the end, on December the 17th, 1903, the first successful flight of a self-propelled heavier-than-air aircraft got off the ground. The machine was piloted by Orville Wright, and it took off near Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, in the USA. With its brother Wilbur, they made their gasoline-propelled driven biplane stay up for 12 seconds, covering a distance of 120 feet. Commercial aviation has a long history, longer than people realise. The first commercial flight was in the United States on July 1, 1914. The 21-mile flight had a flying time of 23 minutes and maintained an altitude of 15 feet. The two-seater aircraft had a small flight deck and carried one paying passenger. This set the scene for commercial flight. Here in the UK, British Airways is our national flag carrier, with full international and domestic air services operating throughout the world. Its origins back to the birth of civil aviation and the pioneering days of World War I, flying in a converted de Havilland DH-4A passenger aircraft. It's over 100 years since the world's first scheduled air service from London to Paris took off from Hounslow Heath Aerodrome, close to today's London's Heathrow. On the 25th of August 1919, carrying just one passenger and a cargo that included newspapers, Devonshire cream, jam and grouse. Air travel has changed beyond all recognition. Each decade has seen a new developments and changes that shape the path of the future. So let's take a look at the different areas of air travel. and see how British Airways became the airline it is today. In 1924, Imperial Airways was formed by the government, the amalgamation of four airline companies, Instone Airline Limited, Handley Page Air Transport Limited, Daimler Airways Limited, and British Marine Air Navigation Limited, making this UK's the first national airline. Imperial began service from London Croydon to European destinations, as well as pioneering routes to Africa and the Middle East and India. On the 4th of May 1926, the first member of the royal family to fly with Imperial Airways was His Royal Highness the Prince of Wales, later King Edward VIII, flying from Paris to London in the Handley Page W10 City of Pretoria. The same year, Imperial Airways introduced three-engine Armstrong Whitworth Argosy on the London-Croydon-Paris route. Imperial Airways de Havilland DH-66 Hercules, a three-engined, seven-seater passenger aircraft, left Croydon on the 3rd of January 1927 for a trial flight to India. With a maximum speed of 129 miles an hour, the flight reached Karachi on the 6th of January, then on to Delhi 2 days later. The flying time from Croydon to Delhi was 62 hours, 27 minutes. In 1927, Imperial Airways launched its silver service to Paris. It was expensive and exclusive. In fact, you could say it was the original first-class type of air travel. With comfortable, recognisable airline cabins, a steward, a full-course luncheon and bar service, the flight took 2 hours 30 minutes, a breakthrough in terms of comfort and service. Responsibility for the comfort and enjoyment of passengers on the Silver Wing flights rested on the shoulders of two stewards. The uniform in 1920 was basic compared with today's styles, with blue trousers, white jackets and peaked caps. They were efficient and smart and were the face of Imperial Airways. The rule book described their job as requiring good manners, tact, a sense of humour, unlimited patience and imagination, which is the power of anticipating passengers' wants and supplying them before they asked. Their appearance was expected to be immaculate. Another quote from the rule book said, "A wilting collar will do much to take the crispness out of a salad." With no room or time for training on flights, stewards were recruited to the airline who had previous experience on cruise ships or Pullman trains. Advertisements appeared in society magazines such as the Tatler. They needed to enjoy travel, not suffer from travel sickness, and they were also expected to have a working knowledge of one or two languages. 2 hours before the flight, stewards had to check passenger numbers, special dietary requirements, and any physical problems, as well as noting any celebrities who would be travelling. Then they would go off to the kitchens at the airport to help prepare the food needed for the flight. However, after some experimentation in the early 30s, a system was devised for hot food to be packed in airtight aluminium containers lined with asbestos, then slotted into a drawer system specially made for the purpose on the aircraft. Before each flight, onboard provisions had to be checked as well, like sugar, biscuits, chocolate and alcohol, to restock where necessary. Onboard, stewards worked from a cramped pantry with small supply of running water. All washing up had to be done before the aircraft landed. Stewards always addressed each other formally and never sat down during the flight. With a journey of just over 2 hours, the meal service had to be streamlined and super efficient. After welcoming passengers on board and showing them their seats, they began to take orders for food and drink as the aircraft taxied along the runway. There were no rules about being seated for take-off and landing for the staff. The whole journey must have been exhausting. Tips were important as their basic wage was £2.10 or £2.50 in today's money to £3 a week. Though they had their immediate family got 10% off travel. Stewards seemed to enjoy being a valued member of an elite team, the opportunity to mix with and serve the rich and famous. Moving on, and in November 1939, the British Overseas Airways Corporation, abbreviated to BOAC, was formed, but a merger of two airlines, Imperial Airways and British Airways Limited. The aircraft were painted in white and blue, Imperial Speedbird logo. Initially, BOAC flew post-war converted military aircraft like the Avro Lancastrian, a civil version of the Avro Lancaster heavy bomber. On the 1st of August 1946, BOAC operations were split. BOAC were to fly long-haul routes and British European Airways, or BEA, flew domestic and European routes. In the 1950s, BOAC flew the Bristol Britannia 175, a medium to long-range turboprop airliner. Built by the Bristol Aeroplane Company, nicknamed the Whispering Giant. Despite Britannia being considered high-tech in turboprop airline design of the time, the Britannia aircraft suffered from various problems that sealed its rather premature death, with only 85 aircraft built between 1952 and 1960. Commercial jet travel really got going when BOAC introduced the de Havilland Comet into its fleet in 1952. The Comet was the first jet-powered passenger aircraft to fly. And that's all for this time. Part 2 around Heathrow next time. So take care, keep a trashing, bye!
Come fly with me, let's fly away. If you can use some exotic booze, there's a bar in far Bombay. Come fly with me, let's fly away. Come fly with me, let's float down to Peru. In Llama Land, there's a one-man band, and he'll toot his flute for you. Come fly with me, let's take off in the blue. Once I get you up there, where the air is rarefied, we'll just fly starry-eyed. Once I get you up there, I'll be holding you so near. You may hear angels cheer, 'cause we're together. Weather-wise, it's such a lovely day. Just say the words and we'll beat the birds down to Acapulco Bay. Perfect for a flying honeymoon, they say. Come fly with me, let's fly away. Once I get you up there, where the air is rarefied, we'll just glide starry-eyed. Once I get you up there, I'll be holding you so near. You may hear angels cheer, 'cause we're together. Weather-wise, it's such a lovely day. You just say the words and we'll beat the birds down to Acapulco Bay. It's perfect for a flying honeymoon, they say. Come fly with me, let's fly, let's fly. Pack up, let's fly away.
Well, what else could we play? The Governor, Frank Sinatra, and Come Fly With Me. Right, more news now, followed very closely by Andy with a tale of a Norwich pub with a serious spirit problem.
And this is some good news, I think. A tap room. Russell Watson of East Norfolk Cider, an award-winning brewery based in Scrappy, is hoping to open a tap room in neighbouring Ormsby St Margaret. The bar would be called the Butcher's Tap Room and showcase the brewery's own cider and apple juice, as well as selling a selection of local ales, spirits and wine, and hot drinks and snacks. The proposed location is on Wapping in the former estate agent's Town and Country, which closed down in September last year. A television will most definitely not be present in the tap room, Mr. Watson said. He added they see the bar not only as a showcase for their products, but also as a meeting place for people to chat to other customers and make new friends. He said the inclusion of board games such as draughts, backgammon, chess and dominoes would encourage people to enjoy their time in the tap room. There would be benches at the front of the building to allow people to sit outside. The proposed name of the bar is a nod to the history of the premises, previously a butcher's shop. Although the premises are small, we hope this will become a well-loved part of the community, Mr. Watson said. We intend to open 7 days a week, which is going against the local trend in the area. The application states there would be one full-time and six part-time employees, while the opening hours would be 9:30 a.m. to 11:30 p.m. every day. East Norfolk Cider have operated from their brewery in Scrappy for 14 years. Using the traditional rack and cloth method, Mr. Watson presses over 3,000 litres of apple juice and cider every year in the village near Great Yarmouth. A decision on the bid, which has been submitted to Great Yarmouth Borough Council, is expected by July the 2nd. Oh, an item here that will please our Dusty. This is about Dance and Musical Theatre Grant. Isabella's Dance and Musical Theatre Company has received a grant from Great Yarmouth Sport and Leisure Trust. The investment will support the implementation of new equipment for the organisation, which has been constantly growing since its establishment in April 2021. Owner and tutor Isabella Weller stated the importance of investing in her growing company to ensure that her students remain engaged. Her commitment towards her stakeholders led her to repeatedly approach the trust for support, ultimately securing funding for new equipment in December 2023. Housed within the Galston Pavilion Theatre, the company offers diverse yet constant leisure activities for the community, including a variety of dance classes and workshops. These include performances at nearby events, charity fundraisers, carnivals and shows, one of which successfully raised £8,200 for the Pavilion Theatre's Restoration Fund in the previous year. Miss Weller said, "The children will love the new equipment and be very excited to try new things during their classes." Graham Plant, chairman of the trust, said, "As a registered charity, our purpose is to benefit the public in the borough of Great Yarmouth. We would like to award more grants to allow more people in the community access to leisure activities such as swimming and sports clubs, or activities such as cycling, grassroots football clubs and gymnastics, for example. Maybe you're a club that needs new equipment. Perhaps you're a coach or a teacher wanting to start a group. We're very keen to help groups who are historically not participating in sport to get involved. And this is another story about the Ice House. The ongoing redevelopment of a building once in the heart of Great Yarmouth's fishing industry has been bolstered by a further £400,000 investment. As its conversion into a national centre for outdoor arts and circus programmes continues, the Ice House will receive almost £500,000 from Arts Council England to help furnish the interior. The building's owners, Out There Arts, have said the funds will go towards an immersive projection experience, additional seating and activities to improve its ability to serve as a heritage learning centre. The additional funding will also go towards making the venue more sustainable and accessible for its future use as a hub for performing arts. Out There Arts Chief Joe McIntosh said, "This investment will allow us to deploy cutting-edge, large-scale immersive experiences for our events. This funding will also purchase tables and chairs for the Ice House and develop a solar-powered trailer, allowing us to reduce the carbon footprint of our events across Great Yarmouth." Work began at the redevelopment in February after the group secured £2 million in funding. The updated Ice House will feature an internal mezzanine, an outside balcony and a lift, and the centre is scheduled to open next year. Two new schools, creating 270 places for children with special educational needs and disabilities, have moved a significant step closer. Plans for the new sites in Great Yarmouth and Downham Market were unveiled in August last year as part of Norfolk County Council's efforts to expand SEND provisions in the county. These plans have now taken a big step forward, with the Department of Education appointing academy trusts to run the schools once they are open. The Downham Market site is set to be run by the Cambridge-based Eastern Learning Alliance, while Unity Schools Partnership has been chosen to lead the Yarmouth site. Eastern Learning Alliance currently runs one other special school, the Cavendish School in Cambridgeshire, while Unity is in charge of four sites in Suffolk. Penny Carpenter, Cabinet Member for Children's Services at Norfolk County Council, said the two trusts had exceptional track records in delivering excellent education and support for children with SEND. She said, "This announcement is a significant step forward, expanding specialist education provision in Norfolk. It is hoped the new schools will be open by September 2026. And this is all about the Priory Building in Yarmouth. It's one of Great Yarmouth's oldest buildings, and its current owners intend to keep it, shaping the town's future. For more than 900 years, the Priory on Priory Plain has been a key venue in the town. Beginning as living quarters for the former monastery at the neighbouring St Nicholas Church, it is most recently remembered as a school and community centre. 3 years ago, the premises were taken over by retired architect Rob Haslam, with plans to create a business hub to develop local entrepreneurs. In that time, the premises have become a go-to wedding venue and office space. On Thursday, dozens of people attended the third anniversary of the Priory 1101 venue. Mr. Haslam said, "Reflecting on where we started and where we are now, it's a bit of a shock. It's remarkable how quickly it's come round. In the past, the building was used very much by local people and charities, and we wanted to keep the ball rolling and expand on that." Mr. Haslam said he always intended to develop the medieval building into a hub, which brought people together, creating something people wanted to be a part of. And with 10 businesses currently based at the site, and a further 8 using the space as and when, Mr. Haslam feels his dream has become a reality. We are sharing energy, expertise and skills, he said. It's important to be able to get local businesses together to create something special. We have a beautiful building steeped in history and we want to use it to help build the area. He added that by working in a central hub, independent businesses have been able to diversify their skills and increase their offerings to customers. With the stunning main hall becoming a popular location for weddings, businesses have been able to assist with creating the perfect day for newlyweds. The Priory also played a key part in a massive local effort to support victims of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, just days before military forces invaded the country in February 2022. Great Yarmouth's new mayor, Paul Waters Bunn, made her first official engagement at Priory 1101's anniversary party, where she gave a speech congratulating the hub for its success over the past 3 years. Ms. Waters Bunn said, "It is lovely to be in such a beautiful building that is steeped in history. To hear all about what's been going on in there over the past years is incredible. It's a privilege to be here on my first official outing as mayor." The new mayor said she expects the next 12 months to be enjoyably busy and is looking forward to finding out about other initiatives across the borough which continue to shape communities. Pre-election promises by Labour. Investing in the region's ports would be a key priority for a future Labour government as part of its plans for a green revolution, a senior member of parliament has said. Dr. Alan Whitehead, Shadow Minister for Energy Security, has signalled cash could be directed towards projects in Great Yarmouth, Lowestoft and Felixstowe as part of the move towards clean energy. He says this would be necessary to unlock the East of England's potential to become a major player in the UK energy sector as one of the biggest providers of wind power. The Southampton MP made the comments at a conference in Cambridge last week, which was organised by the Eastern Powerhouse, a group calling for more government investment in the region. Mr. Whitehead said, "The green energy revolution will need enormous investment in every region, but the East has tremendous possibilities that need to be taken advantage of. It has all the attributes to become a major player in the future." The East Coast's port assets are seriously underutilised, but they will be a pivotal tool in making the revolution work. "We are expecting a fourfold increase in offshore wind energy, which will land in the East. Places like Great Yarmouth, Lowestoft and Felixstowe will play a key role in providing services to these farms and the facilities that will need to be upgraded to facilitate this." He said that these port locations could become centres for green energy manufacturing as part of the plans due to being on the front line of the energy industry. Mr. Whitehead also said supporting the completion of the sizeable sea nuclear power project in Suffolk would be a priority for a Labour government. However, Labour's promises of investment have become increasingly muddled after Sir Keir Starmer dropped the flagship policy of spending £28 billion a year on green projects. The move was blasted by environment campaigners when it was announced in February, and it remains unclear what this means for the promised investments and how the money would be split. East Anglia is at the heart of the UK's renewable energy sector, with 43% of the nation's offshore wind generated on our shores. But industry experts warn that soaring costs, a growing skills gap, and limited infrastructure to support the expanding sector are creating unprecedented difficulties. Labour says it will create 56,000 new jobs in the region by investing in this sector to help change this. Cash to support this will come through creating Great British Energy, a publicly owned energy company. Profits raised will be invested in a national wealth fund that can support the training necessary to tackle the skills gap, while also being used for developing clean energy technologies. However, industry leaders warned Mr. Whitehead that major improvements were needed to the region's roads for the ports to flourish in the future. An Ipswich-based businessman warned that problems at Orwell Bridge, which is frequently forced to shut due to bad weather, are hampering the growth of Felixstowe, the biggest container port in the country, due to difficulties in transporting freight via the road network. Stalling road improvements in Norfolk, such as the A47 and Norwich Western Link, are also proving a hurdle. Chloe Smith, Conservative MP for Norwich North, told attendees that improvements to the rail network are just as important as roads. She added that the proposal to enhance the capacity of Ely Junction in Cambridgeshire is vital for unlocking the eastern ports to the rest of the country. A push for railway improvements is central to Eastern Powerhouse's vision for creating a more unified economy in the region. The group is currently consulting with West Norfolk Council to identify how it can help with lobbying the government for funding to create a new railway station on land south of King's Lynn. It is also speaking with Norfolk Councils to identify railway stations across the county that could be developed into so-called business hubs, a plan to bring new investment to decaying stations and to encourage companies to locate their operations close to the railway network. D-Day Wreaths. She is a little boat with a lot of history and a big story to tell. And this week, Rummy 3 will be embarking on a new chapter as she heads across the Channel to Normandy to take part in the 80th D-Day anniversary. The 42-foot vessel, which has served a variety of military roles in the Second World War, mostly in Norfolk, is owned by Andy Smurden, 56, and Susan Lansdell, 36. The couple who live aboard hope to use her to tell the forgotten story of the Royal Navy's fleet of requisitioned small boats, which were pressed into military service during the war. The couple are currently in Southwold, making final preparations for their voyage, and are due to set off on Tuesday on a 3-week trip to Normandy via Ostend. They plan to arrive in Normandy by June the 6th, the 80th anniversary of the landings, and to lay wreaths on behalf of the Royal Navy Patrol Service Association. The association represents veterans, relatives and enthusiasts of the Royal Navy Patrol Service, which operated small vessels carrying out anti-submarine, minesweeping, coastal protection and other roles during both world wars, often in waters off the east coast. The sometimes overlooked service, which had its headquarters in what is now the Lowestoft Maritime Museum, often relied on outdated, ill-suited and poorly armed vessels, which were requisitioned from civilian or fishing use. These were often crewed by ex-fishermen, and this decidedly unglamorous fleet earned a number of nicknames, including Churchill's Pirates and Harry Tate's Navy, a reference to a clumsy musical hall entertainer who struggled with various contraptions. Mr. Smurden, a truck driver, said, "We wanted to help commemorate the people that served in the war. There was a battle going on off the East Coast that doesn't get much attention. Some of the earliest sinkings of the Second World War were just off the coast. There are hundreds of wrecks off places like Southwold and Lowestoft, and most of them are requisitioned vessels like Rummy. The people that manned these boats were the Royal Navy Patrol Service people, mostly fishermen that had volunteered and been co-opted into the war. Rummy 3 was built in 1935 at Thorn near Doncaster and requisitioned in 1940. She was first used as a senior naval officer's boat in Boston, Lincolnshire. In 1942, she was transferred to Great Yarmouth, where she was used as a fire boat. She still has a working fire pump. She was later renamed HMS Flycatcher and attached to the Royal Naval Station of the same name at Ludham after the Admiralty took over the airfield there from the RAF. At the time, she was nominally a depot ship, but was mostly used by the unit to make trips to places like Yarmouth. At the end of the war, she was laid up in Sanderson Yard at Reedham before being sold out of service. She was then rebuilt by Herbert Woods at Potterheim and entered private ownership.
And another from the occasional Weird Norfolk series. And we're back to the ghosts and ghouls. Icy chills and the sound of a baby crying. Floating faces caught on CCTV. Shadowy figures after closing time. Threatening whispers. Norwich's The Ferry Boat Inn had many haunting stories. The now abandoned pub on King Street used to be a lively watering hole which welcomed local and national bands and was part of the city's pub scene since 1811. Those with long memories might remember those well-worn seats in the front bar that looked remarkably similar to those used by the Eastern Counties Omnibus Company, and the stuffed cat guarding the chimney breast, or Fagas Lil on the piano in the 1970s and 80s. Maybe you can recall Ted, the rag and bone man, who still used a cart into the 1980s and spent his earnings behind the bar. Or were you one of the Argyle Street squatters who adopted the pub as their local? Stretch even further back, and there was the famous landlady, Mottie Warminger, who ran the pub from the Second World War for 3 decades, presiding over the bar with queenly grace until the ripe old age of 84. It's been run by male and female landlords, by fishermen and the Sheriff of Norwich. Alan Thorpe and his wife leased the Riverside pub for 2 years, from 2004 to 2006, until it was forced to close due to noise complaints from the recently built blocks of flats nearby. Number 191 King Street was an inn since it was built in the 17th century and became the ferry boat during the World War I when Bolton and Paul opened their works on the other side of the Wensum and a ferry operated to bring workers across. It had 3 stories, original fireplaces and attics, 2 Elizabethan cellars and a blocked door to what was once a secret room, or possibly less romantically, a garderobe or old toilet. The remains of a 16th century arch were found in an outbuilding next to the inn. Alan told Weird Norfolk, "I was very much a sceptic about things that go bump in the night, but had all changed in the 2 years we were at the ferry boat." The pub had been a live music pub for many years, and we continued this, having live local and national upcoming bands most nights of the week, so the pub had a young and vibrant atmosphere. When the pub was closed to the public, things were a bit different. As the pub was old, it had hidden stairs, 5 bedrooms, tight, twisty main stairs, and walls warped with oak beams in the ceiling. Obviously, some rooms, due to their age, felt creepy and cold, but you'd expect that. There was 1 bedroom on its own on the 3rd floor. About 6 months after moving in, we decided to use this bedroom as it was furthest away from the normal noises of the pub and was brightest of rooms of staff accommodation. The only problem was that the atmosphere in the bedroom was icy cold. You felt like you'd cut the air with a knife, it was so cold. No other room in the pub was so bad, not even the beer cellar. In the mornings, I'd be woken up by the thick, icy atmosphere, even when the sun was bright and warm. Also, I was woken by the sound of a baby crying every day, even though my wife never heard it, and most buildings near the pub at that point were non-residential. The Thorpes quickly abandoned the bedroom, moving to a 2nd-floor bedroom until they left the pub in 2006. Alan said, "When we closed the pub at the end of the day, we used to sit in the front bar and have a couple of drinks or a cup of tea to soak up the quiet and put our feet up while we cashed up the till. Every night we would look down a narrow hallway, which led to a wider hallway between a games room with pool table and the public toilets. We'd see people, shaped shadows, walk from side to side of the hallway,
just like they were wandering about. We'd always check the rooms to make sure we had no straggling customers, and the rooms were always empty. But the spirits were not threatening, so we just got used to seeing them there each night. Alan added there had been two separate incidents where items had gone missing, which he and his wife had blamed on the spirits in the pub that weren't in the bottles behind the bar. One involved essential parts of a television being moved to a strange location while no one was in the pub. Another saw a desperately needed warranty turn up, 3 months too late, under a heavy ice machine that was never moved and had been in place for years. "I am now a firm believer in ghosts," said Alan. Another weird Norfolk reader shared her stories of the ferry boat inn from when she worked behind the bar. "I was working late one night, clearing up towards the end of my shift, when I heard an indiscernible whispering in my ear, which I heard as, 'Get out,' and it really spooked me. There were only two regulars at the bar as it was the end of the night. They didn't hear it, but I did, and it scared me, and I've questioned myself ever since, but I did hear it, no doubt." She added that staff felt uneasy about working in the middle bar, and that a landlord prior to Alan's tenure had lived upstairs in the pub with his wife and daughters and had reported strange events at the inn. The youngest daughter told her parents she was continually woken up by a man touching her feet while she was trying to sleep. And another incident was caught on the security camera located in the top left-hand corner of the front bar, said the former barmaid. Way after closing time, an old boy in a flat cap was seen roaming around, but he actually put his face right up to the lens of the camera, which had to be about 7.5 feet from the floor. The ferry boat inn fell into disrepair and was boarded up after it closed in 2006, and the pub group Green King, which owned it, considered developing the site into a pub restaurant, but it wasn't a viable investment. In December 2006, the pub hit the headlines after it was revealed Suffolk serial killer Steve Wright was once landlord. Wright is now serving a life sentence in prison for killing 5 women in Ipswich. The King Street site is currently being developed for housing. Perhaps the ferry boat spirits will take advantage of the new accommodation. Watch this space.
No.
spirits, whichever type you fancy, in a material world from the police. Right, it's time to get you fully up to date now with the rest of this week's local news.
And an item about BBC Countryfile. Countryfile presenter Tom Heap will be special guest when a thought-provoking new play set on a Norfolk farm is performed in Great Yarmouth. Best known for his investigations on the popular BBC show, Mr. Heap will watch a performance of Phoenix, Dodo, Butterfly on May the 25th, and then discuss the nature and climate issues it highlights. The 50-minute play by dramatist Steve Waters of the University of East Anglia, UEA, sees farmer Martin, partner Becky and estranged daughter Amy seek to find their way through three futures of flood, fire and drought. As a passionate advocate for rural issues, Mr. Heap said he's looking forward to returning to Norfolk, which is a regular filming location. He regularly presents on TV and radio about land management and climate change, and has also written books on the subject, which he believes needs to be covered in new and engaging ways, including drama. From a journalistic point of view, climate change is an amazing story. The stakes couldn't be higher. We're all involved. It's got tragedy and disaster. It's also got solution and redemption and heroes, he said. It's also got some of the makings of what puts people off stories. Basically, they think it's about them being guilty and slightly powerless, so they feel they might end up feeling worse at the end of whatever it might be, a 3-minute TV news package or a half-hour documentary or even a 4-day book read. Mr. Heap said there are real dilemmas in managing the British countryside to balance the priorities of food, nature and climate, plus the lives and welfare of the people who live there. I'm not someone who believes we should go full on for the nature side alone, because I think we should just push our food requirement to the rest of the world, and we end up ruining their nature and pushing out more carbon. I don't think it's a very honest way to behave, he said. Phoenix, Dodo, Butterfly is inspired by the opening chapter of a book by Rupert Reed, Emeritus Associate Professor at UEA and co-director of the Climate Majority Project, entitled This Civilization is Finished. Dr. Reed said, "The wonderful thing about drama is it can bring the future that it depicts alive to us. It's thrilling to see the kinds of possible futures, bad, ugly and good, that we may choose together to make, staged for us to contemplate." Mr. Heap, who is based in Warwickshire, describes Countryfile as one of the luckiest jobs in British journalism because he gets to travel to usually beautiful places and meet fascinating and interesting people. He said he relishes the chance to dig deeper into key issues and cover controversial stories, adding, "Countryfile can feel a little bit like a warm bath, but I think with the addition of the investigations, it's a warm bath with a good book. It's got something to sink your mental teeth into. I think as well as people enjoying the films we make, it lends authenticity to the whole programme. It stops it being viewed simply as a sort of advert, and that matters." Phoenix, Dodo, Butterfly will be performed at the Drill House, Great Yarmouth at 7:30 p.m. on May the 25th as part of the Norfolk and Norwich Festival before going on a summer tour, including venues in Sheringham, Lowestoft and Wisbeach. It was also staged earlier this week at the John Innes Centre in Norwich, followed by a panel debate with farmers, an agronomist and an environmental advisor. Who is Great Yarmouth's Tory candidate? Great Yarmouth will be in the dark a little longer about who the Conservative Party candidate will be in the upcoming general election. The Prime Minister announced on Wednesday the country will go to the polls on July the 4th. Following Sir Brandon Lewis's announcement in March that he would not be standing again, the Conservatives have yet to name a candidate for Great Yarmouth. The town's Tory chairman, Robert Price, said his team had been planning for an October election, so it could be another 10 days before the candidate is announced, giving the party only 5 weeks of campaigning. Mr. Price says he feels this is not a disadvantage, as it will allow the party to concentrate all their efforts during the campaign. I would have thought people would know who the candidate is in about 10 days' time, said Mr. Price. The rules say we now have to go into by-election mode, where the applications that are in now going to be dealt with at central office. We will be in contact with them hopefully today, and we'll get the final three or four nominations coming to us on a fast track. And then we'll decide very quickly. Mr. Price said until Rishi Sunak's announcement yesterday, the Yarmouth branch was on track for announcing its new candidate by the end of June, in time for an election later in the year. He added, "We were planning for an October election and then have 4 months of campaigning. That period will now be 4 to 5 weeks, so it will be a concentrated effort. I don't think it will be a disadvantage to us, because we're putting everything into that short term so people will know in a short span of time what is going on. The only caveat I do have is that we don't actually name who that shortlisted candidate is who will be the person representing the Conservative Party. The names are in, but I don't know what they're going to give us." Labour announced Keir Cousins as the Yarmouth parliamentary candidate last August. In April, ex-football boss and businessman Rupert Lowe announced his hope to become Great Yarmouth's next MP, standing as a candidate for Reform, the latest political venture fronted by Nigel Farage. Mr. Lowe said he will support the region's fishing trade and the farming industry. It has also been announced Trevor Rawson will be standing for the Green Party. Oh, and this is quite a horrific story. I do apologise for any dog owners. Doberman attacks groups of dogs. An 87-year-old woman has been left shaken after a Doberman attacked her three dogs on Great Yarmouth Beach. Sarah King said her elderly mother and a friend were walking their dogs between the Wellington Pier and the Pleasure Beach. The four dogs, including three Shelties, were strolling along the beach when two women appeared in the dunes and a Doberman shot out and attacked the group. Mum heard her eldest dog cry out and she saw her on her back in the sand, having been pinned down or flipped over, Miss King said. As her three dogs ran away, the Doberman chased them. Two of the Shelties fled across the road while the third ran up to her mother on the promenade. Her mother was forced to clutch the wall for support in case the Doberman knocked her down as it followed. "It went for my mum's dog that was with her and grabbed hold of my mum's leg," Miss King recalled. "She had a pair of waterproofs over her trousers and the dog grabbed hold of these too before running off to chase the others. The missing dogs were tracked down with the help of passers-by, but one of their coats was ripped to shreds. Both of the mystery women and their dogs had disappeared by the time the group was reunited. Mum was very shaken up, and one of the dogs was shaky and withdrawn for a couple of days after," Miss King said. Miss King, who had been a qualified veterinary nurse for 32 years, said she has seen many dogs with very different temperaments and is sure her mum's Shelties do not have a malicious bone in their bodies. "I just want to get the story out there to start a conversation," she said. "There are secure dog parks available over the area, with more popping up all the time. There is really no excuse to have a dog with that temperament off-lead in a public place." A spokeswoman for Norfolk Constabulary said they had received a report of the incident at 7:16 p.m. on Thursday, May the 16th, and the officer has organised to speak with the victim. And another sad story about animals. An exhausted and underweight seal has been given a second chance after she was found with a plastic ring around her neck. A vet battled to remove the flying ring, which was deeply embedded in her neck and had caused a severe wound that had become infected. The seal, named Ghostbug, is the latest to be rehabilitated by RSPCA East Winch after Friends of Horsey Seals rescued her. As with all seals who suffer entanglements, the grey seal was taken to the Wildlife Centre in need of urgent medical attention. Her treatments included regular salt baths to help the wound heal, alongside antibiotics and anti-inflammatories. Evangelos Sakilios, centre manager, said, "This small toy, when caught around a seal, can cause so much damage, and we only see the ones who are thankfully rescued. It's just awful to think that out there will be others who have suffered a sad fate because of man-made items polluting our seas. Ghostbug's injury has healed well, but she will always have a permanent scar as a result. After weeks of treatment, she was taken back to Horsey to be released into the sea." Seal volunteers and members of the public watched the heartwarming moment when she was successfully released back into the wild. "It's always a very moving moment when you watch them return back to the wild," Mr. Achilios added. "It's just wonderful knowing that thanks to everyone's efforts, this seal has been given a second chance." The RSPCA and other organisations have been campaigning for people not to use these types of flying rings. Many councils have agreed to ban them and promote the Safer Seals campaign along the Norfolk coast.
Well, that's it for this week's edition, which is copyright 2024 of the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association. News content is adapted mainly from the Great Yarmouth Mercury. However, the Great Yarmouth and District Talking Newspaper Association accept responsibility for editorial decisions made for this recording. Don't forget, you can contact us from our website on grapevinegy.org if you have any queries over our service. Your newsreader next week will be Andrew, so we hope for your company then for much more of your local news. In the meantime, from all of us at Grapevine, stay safe and well. Let's hope the weather keeps warming up. And from everyone here, it's bye for now.